Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we've got Stephen Fromm, Chief Executive Officer of Aruna Bio, who discussed its investigational exosome candidate AB126 and the upcoming 1B2A trial in patients with ischemic stroke. He provided context on the mechanism of action of this neuroprotectant, the complexities with conducting stroke trials, and the difficulties with repairing neurodegeneration following stroke. Let's dive in.
If you know much about stroke, it's really been a difficult area for clinical development, especially for neuroprotectants or anything that's not a thrombolytic. Even the thrombolytics, I mean, TPA, which got approved back in 96, it's the only drug that's ever been approved for the treatment of acute ischemic stroke, okay? And it had difficulty even getting through the clinical. And because of that, there's this whole roundtable. I don't know if you're familiar with STERE, which is an acronym, but they became involved and they came together in 98. They had their first meeting in 99 just to help the whole community try to figure out how to get through, you know, the clinical development stage. So even myself, my background wasn't CNS. Most of my time as a CEO has been in the ophthalmology space. So I'm new to the CNS space. I've been CEO of this company for just under 2 years. So I had a huge steep learning curve to really understand not just stroke, but the whole CNS, because we're also doing neurodegeneration with our AB126 product, but stroke's the lead indication. And, you know, that's what the IND that just got cleared, it's for treating stroke. And so I'm really trying to get my head wrapped around why have all these products failed? And there are a lot of reasons, but a lot of the times it starts with the clinical design. And part of the problem with clinical design is you got to work with the tools you have. And the tools have really evolved in stroke over the last 5 years. Things have really evolved since thrombectomies have really improved since, you know, 2015. But things have really changed. And there's a lot more information because of the thrombectomy procedure and how successful it's been. There's a lot more data out there. So the first thing was really trying to put together an appropriate protocol for our very first study in patients. It is a safety study and it's designed as a safety study. So it's your traditional dose ascending trial. Okay, so we're going to start with a low dose, then go to medium dose, then to a high dose. So we actually have four cohorts. Each cohort will be four patients, three in one regimen. So three treated, one placebo. And we start with the first cohort of four, make sure it's safe, then we'll go up to the next one. When we get to the high dose, assuming everything worked well there, we'll repeat it. So that's why there's four cohorts. All right, so if everything's perfect, we have 16 subjects. And it's not meant to be a large study. It's meant to prove we're the first exosome company using a therapeutic exosome going into the clinic for a CNS condition, okay? And so the FDA doesn't have a lot of experience around exosomes. There aren't many exosomes that have been in the clinic. And, you know, we can talk about that for a long time. But going into the clinic with an exosome is really important also for approaching stroke. But I'll table that for right now because we're talking about clinical design. So I had to really think this through because the design I really wanted to show because we're going into patients is the best design for showing efficacy, but it's a safety study. But I have to think about it from also an investor point of view because regardless of whether the FDA cares about it as a safety study, it's in patients and all investors are going to care about is did we show efficacy? Safety becomes one line item on the deck, on the corporate deck. But from an FDA point of view, it is the whole deck. So I have to think about safety and efficacy, but from a safety perspective first, we wanted to see if we could get the most homogenous patient population we could and get rid of a lot of the noise or the background noise from a safety perspective. And what I mean by that is, again, exosomes are new and going in there, it's a new modality, okay, it really is. And going in there, we're under the cell and gene therapy portion of the FDA. And so they want us to go slow. They want everything to go slow. And anytime there's going to be a very severe adverse reaction or there's going to be a death, which happens in stroke, they want us to stop and make sure it wasn't treatment emergent. So you want to make sure you're getting rid of a lot of those very severe or the background noise, as I call it, so that we don't have to take 2 years to do a small study. So that's what led us to thrombectomy patients. Okay, thrombectomy patients have to have a certain profile in order to have a thrombectomy, which can be traumatic in its own right. Okay, so we started with that. Although the thrombectomy patient population probably isn't the right population to show the true benefit of our product, but it is the right population probably for a safety study. So we're doing dose ascending in thrombectomy, but I'm going to take it one step further. And this is where I'm really pushing our ad board and our PI, is we now know that these guys are great at doing thrombectomies now. Their Tiki scores, we don't even worry about their scores anymore. Their reperfusion rates are just, they're absolute. So, but even with that, only about 50% resolution is happening. 50% of the population is resolving, you know, to a modified Rankin scale of, you know, less than two. So what about the other 50%? So that's where our protocol is really, and I think this comes with all of the literature that's, you know, come out in the last 5 years. We're really trying to understand, is there something that could help us identify that 50% of the population that will have a poor prognosis at day 90, which is the endpoint? If we could do that, it'll help us shine in showing the true efficacy of our product. So that's where a lot of our brainstorming is going on, is how do we do that? Because there's no perfect prognosticator out there, but there are things that we can do to help us try to find and identify those that could have a poor prognosis. And there aren't any, I haven't seen any protocols of any clinical studies that have really tried to do that, really tried to understand and identify those with a low or poor prognosis. And I think that's what will help us in this smaller first study show what our capabilities are.
Let's talk a little bit about the drug specifically. Talk a little bit about the origin of AB126. Talk a little bit about the mechanism of action and why we believe that it can be an advantageous type of therapy in this field.
Yeah, I'm a little biased, but I'll go into it. So, you know, it all starts with our chief science officer, who's the founder of the company, Dr. Stice. So Steve Stice has been in the cell therapy field for, this will age him, but going on like 40 years. He's been working with neural stem cells for about 20 years. This guy has so much experience working in this field. It's one of the reasons why I became CEO of the company, because of the experience this guy has, and also because of the complexity of our product, okay? There's a lot of factors that go into all of this, but so he's been working with neural stem cells, as I mentioned, for about 20 years. He actually published some papers as far back as 2009 showing that neural stem cells have a very positive effect in stroke models. But what we were finding, the stem cells themselves didn't get to the stroke or the infarct region, but the infarct region was still having this benefit. So two and two together, something that's being produced by the stem cells is allowing for this therapy to be actively treating the stroke. And that's where, you know, eventually over time, we learned that extracellular vesicles were being produced, and they're largely responsible for a lot of the therapeutic effect. And so hence about 6-7 years ago, they started up an exosome company. So it's not all extracellular vesicles, they're specifically looking at exosomes, which have a certain size. And these exosomes carry a lot of the biomolecules, and they also have biomolecules or proteins on the exterior surface that you would see coming from a neural stem cell. So all cells pretty well produce exosomes. Exosomes are first and foremost used for communicating and regulating like-type cells, all right? So they're going to have a footprint of the characteristics of the parent cell that makes them, right? So hence, neural stem cells are going to have characteristics that are ideal for working in the CNS space. It's also what helps facilitate crossing the blood-brain barrier, all right? We have markers on the exterior surface that allows us to do that. We also, so what's really interesting, there's three things going on, because we obviously, our route of administration is systemic. We do an IV push right now for the acute conditions. So we see, first and foremost, facilitation across the blood-brain barrier. Then we see, because of their anti-inflammatory characteristics, we also have some proteins on the exterior surface that allow for migration to the area of injury, whether that be an acute injury or even chronic. So obviously we have some anti-inflammatory characteristics because we see it going to the area of inflammation within the brain. Then once it's in that area, we see tropism predominantly to the neurons. We'll see some to the other glial cells as well, but predominantly we'll see a tropism effect to the neurons. So all of these things make it ideal for treating these conditions in the brain. Now, getting to an acute injury like stroke, but even some of the chronic ones, these are very complex, multifactorial conditions. There's a lot going on. So to think that maybe just a neuroprotectant, especially in the hyperacute or acute stage of stroke, that a neuroprotectant on its own is going to work, it's difficult. So, but if you have a product that can act as not just a neuroprotectant, but also an anti-inflammatory and also have some regenerative capabilities, that could be huge. And so that's what this is. That's how complex an exosome is. I do not believe that man, pharmaceutical companies, biotech, has the ability to make in one product something that has all of these factors. But biology does, obviously Mother Nature does. And so we're just harnessing what our body already makes. Our body makes these exosomes. In the brain, though, we do have stem cells, but they don't have the same regenerative capabilities as we get older. As we age, it has less and less regenerative capabilities, these stem cells. So we're augmenting that. That's all we're doing. We're pushing in a lot more of these exosomes that have these regenerative capabilities, but also have anti-inflammatory and protective abilities.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Stephen to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, on February 12th, the European Commission approved Biogen's omaveloxolone as a treatment for patients with Friedreich ataxia, indicated for adults and adolescents aged 16 years and older with the disease. The therapy was approved based on data from the Phase 3 MOXIe Part 2 trial, a 48-week placebo-controlled study. On the same day, top-line results from a Phase 3 trial assessing AVP-786, a CYP2D6 inhibitor, showed that the treatment failed to distinguish itself from placebo in treating patients with Alzheimer's disease agitation. Otsuka, the drug developers, plan to analyze additional pre-specified and exploratory analyses of the data set to determine the full potential of the agent. And finally, on February 16th, the FDA accepted and filed Sarepta Therapeutics' efficacy supplement to the biologics license application for the approved gene therapy SRP-9001 for the treatment of ambulatory patients with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. The agency granted the efficacy supplement a priority review with a review goal date of June 21st, 2024, and has also confirmed not to plan to hold an advisory committee meeting to discuss the supplement. For more information about these stories, head to neurologylive.com, or you can check out this corresponding link in the show notes. And now, back to our conversation with Stephen.
A lot of these neurologic disorders, they're not really handled by one therapy, most of the time handled by sort of a concoction of therapies or things of that sort, which kind of leads me to my next question. This may be a little bit early, but how do you feel as though that this therapy would fit in the stroke treatment landscape? Do you envision any issues with drug-to-drug combinations or things of that sort? Obviously, I know that there's typically a lot of calcium channel blockers, beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, and things of that sort. So I'm just curious if you guys, when you're thinking about these things, if there was any sort of complications or even to the opposite point, synergistic effects, just thoughts on that.
Yeah, all good points, Marco. So yes, we are thinking about that, but again, it's a complex product and we kind of got to start with the basics and, you know, kind of the MOA, how is this even working? And how do you do that? I mean, you can't just put it in a machine and it'll spit out what's going on. So we start with the pharmacology and we start with the actual animal models and what is it doing? Is it doing anything? And so even you know, from the STAIR recommendations, putting a robust preclinical package together is important. And that's what we started with. And when you start doing that, so we used multiple different types of stroke models, multiple different species, even within rodents, we did middle-aged, aged, you know, we did, you know, permanent occlusion, we did transient occlusion, we've tried all bunch of different things. And we're seeing signs of all three of the capabilities that I mentioned to you, anti-inflammatory, even neuroprotection, and some regenerative capabilities. We're seeing that. We even did a pig model, right? So going into the larger brain, we did all of these things, and the product works really, really well. It's amazing how well it works, and hopefully it'll translate into the clinic in the same fashion that we're seeing preclinically. But to get to your point, so we're starting with, well, what does it do? And we're seeing some of these capabilities. You know, we're looking at some of the inflammatory markers, the traditional ones, IL-1 beta, TNF alpha, and we see we're downregulating some of these. And then we start to put together other pieces, and we go and do some in vitro assays to understand how are we doing this? How are we affecting it? What pathway is doing that? And a lot of our work, our initial work, is around inflammation, right? We did a little bit of neuroprotection. We were trying to do too much at once. When I came on board, we said, let's just focus on the inflammation part of it. Pretty well every disease has inflammation involved, right? Whether it be acute or chronic. So we wanted to start there. And what's interesting is we want to work on one pathway first. So we started looking at some obvious information, and a lot of signals were pointing to the inflammasome, a lot of them. And so even upregulation of differentiation of Tregs, all right, from the CD4, CD8 effector cells, a whole bunch of things were coming together, IL-1 beta, RIPK1, caspase. So we started looking at what are the different ways that you can activate the caspase. And so we started doing that so that you can see that's how we had to go about it. And we came down to what we found out on the external surface of our exosome are two ectoenzymes that are upregulated and showing there, CD39 and 72. They happen to be the same two enzymes that are upregulated on Tregs. Tregs uses multiple pathways as well, right, to modulate the immune system. This is one of them. And so they play a very important role, especially in acute conditions, going up against one of the major DAMPs, DAMPs, which happens to be what's called the ATP adenosine axis. And so they play a very strong role there. And a lot of ATP is, you know, released from the neurons or the cells that are dying in acute and chronic conditions. And so we put a lot of effort into really understanding that this axis plays a role in the conditions we're looking at, but also our enzyme, or sorry, our exosomes plays a role there. That's one example. But there's so many pathways that we play a role in. And so we're trying to uncover them one at a time, all right, methodically. But that's the beauty of our product. There's pros and cons because, you know, some people have a problem with the fact that it works on so many pathways. They would prefer that it's more simple. You're an antibody or bispecific, you know exactly what to look for. But, you know, simple maybe isn't what's required here in these very multifactorial conditions and diseases.
The last question for you, Stephen, and I appreciate you taking some time out of your day. It's awesome to hear about the drug and the trial itself. But the last question for you is a little bit different. Obviously, you've only been, you know, at the company for a couple of years now, but, you know, why has repairing neurodegeneration following stroke and just the neurodegenerative aspects of stroke, why has that been so difficult, and why haven't we seen as much success in this field specifically?
Yeah, well, I think that comes, I think, you know, a lot of factors are at play here, and I think I've discussed some of them. One is, you know, we need to make sure that you're recruiting the right population, and that hasn't been so easy. And, you know, there's a lot more data out there now to help us really understand. You have to have the right population for your drug, right? It's not, you know, and it's been tough to be able to find that population for drugs. But I think more importantly, I think that's less the issue. I think the bigger issue is with an acute injury like a stroke, it is very extreme the response the body has from an inflammatory point of view, okay, depending on how severe the stroke is, you know, all the way up to some severe swelling and so forth. And I think to just think that you're going to be a neuroprotectant in this extreme environment, and, you know, it may be a very potent neuroprotectant, but there's going to be a lot of inflammation. The immune response is strong at the very, in the hyperacute and acute stages, it's really strong. I think they would have better effect if they actually combined it with an anti-inflammatory. I think then you'll see a lot more, you know, positive data coming with these neuroprotectants. I think if you put the neuroprotectant into a less inflamed environment, obviously there'll still be inflammation, they may have more success. So maybe if they took a later stage in stroke or in chronic conditions, they may have a better effect. But if you're going into that very extreme environment with an acute injury, you're going to have to modulate the immune system and the inflammatory response. I believe that. I could be wrong, but and our product is an it does all three in one. It can't be great at all three, but again, we didn't design it. This is, you know, millions of years of evolution designed our product, not us. We just know how to harness it. We got a guy that chose the right cell line. Even the cell line, it's not like he derived one cell line. It's a neuroprogenitor cell. He derived many. And he determined which one's producing the most therapeutic exosome that could be used. And that's the cell line we licensed from his university that he works at, University of Georgia. Okay, so, but a complex product, I think, is what's going to be required to help these patients that have complex diseases or conditions.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.